This is Jeff Blankford. My guest on Takes on the World today, Donald McIntyre, was a Jerusalem correspondent for the Independent of London from 2004 to 2012, mainly covering Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, but also traveling to Iraq, Turkey, Egypt, and Libya for the paper, on which from 1996 to 2004 he had been the chief political commentator. In 2011, he received the Peace Through Media Award of the Next Century Foundation, and I expect he'll win some others with his new book, Gaza, Preparing for Dawn, recently published in London by One World Books, about which we'll be speaking this morning. Welcome, Donald McIntyre, to Takes on the World.
Hi, nice to hear you.
Well, very glad to have you aboard a marvelous book. Just 2 weeks ago, we seemed to be on the verge of another war by Israel on Gaza, which would have been its fourth in the space of a decade. Then suddenly we had a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas that divided and briefly threatened to bring down the Israeli government. Can you explain to us what happened as you see it?
Well, I think the developments were quite, you know, took a very unexpected turn. There's no doubt that the Egyptians had been trying very seriously to mediate a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. And in particular, they were worried that the border protests, the Great March of Return, as it's known, which have been going on since actually March the 30th, which have seen a very large number of Palestinian casualties, some 200 killed, some 22,000 injured, would escalate into a full-scale war. Now, those negotiations seem to be going okay. There was a kind of commonality. Hamas probably didn't want a war. Egypt certainly didn't want a war. And at least elements in the Israeli military didn't want a war either. I mean, we can talk about why that was a bit later. Now, that all seemed to be moving towards a ceasefire. And then a clandestine operation by the Israeli military inside Gaza was exposed by Hamas, and that created a very vigorous firefight in which a Hamas commander and the Israeli officer who was leading this mission, this undercover mission in southern Gaza, were both killed, and there was an immediate burst of rocket fire, and it looked to many, many people as though these efforts by the Egyptians, particularly to broker a ceasefire, were over. Then, and you know, the Middle East never ceases to surprise. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, didn't, in fact, abort the ceasefire negotiations, despite considerable pressure from practically every political party in Israel, with the exception of Meretz, I think, the most left-wing of the Zionist parties. I mean, Labour was all for, you know, a major operation in Gaza. So too was Yair Lapid, who leads a kind of centrist secular party. And so was Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister, who resigned in protest at a decision which was taken by Netanyahu. I think everybody was a bit surprised by this, to go ahead with a ceasefire. And my guess, and I'm speculating here, my guess is that Netanyahu had a direct line there to senior figures in the Israeli military who, A, are more worried about what may be happening in Syria at the moment, and B, even people in the Israeli military recognize that the humanitarian and economic situation in Gaza is now so dire that something has to be done. You know, A, something has to be done to kind of create a more peaceful circumstance, and secondly, that a war was really not going to achieve anything at all, least of all, by the way, reinforce Israeli security. So I think that's basically what happened. But, you know, it's been a surprise to see left-wing commentators like Gideon Levy, a journalist I very much admire, in Haaretz, saying, well, you know, I've never liked him, I never will, But you know what? Netanyahu did the right thing here.
Yes, that's quite extraordinary. And actually, he stared down the National Home Party that threatened to pull out from the government if its ultra-right-wing head, Naftali Bennett, was not made defense minister. And now it seems that Netanyahu is not only prime minister and foreign minister, he's now also the defense minister. It's a strained situation. But the situation at the border, I had mentioned earlier in the program, before I called you, that...
Right.
I compared it with the situation at the U.S. border with Mexico, and even though the historical situation is very different, U.S. foreign policy has engineered both of these protests and by supporting Israel to the bloody hilt in Gaza and the West Bank and so on, in its wars on Gaza, and also what the role has played in the countries in Central America, you can actually put that blame. But perhaps Egypt was looking at the U.S. border and worrying that could have happened at Rafah because Egypt's collaboration on the border with Israel is key. Perhaps you comment on that and the difference with today and when the way it was with Mohamed Morsi.
Yes, well, you've raised a couple of very important questions there. I mean, first of all, I think you're right to draw some parallels. I mean, one can't help feeling that Donald Trump's treatment of the U.S.-Mexico border seems to be planning to take a leaf out of the Israeli military's book by making this a kind of, you know, promising to shoot, effectively to kill, if there's an encroachment over the border. But I think the more important question that you raise probably is the more immediate question that you raise is this one about Egypt and the southern border. I think Egypt's president, Sisi, has no love, to put it mildly, for Hamas, quite the contrary. And you're right, unlike the situation when Morsi was president and there was a tangibly good relationship between Hamas and Gaza and the regime then in Cairo, that is certainly not the case. However, I think that the Egyptians have sort of evolved a bit since the period where they were doing really everything to make Hamas's life as difficult as they possibly could. And the reason for this, I think, is that they fear that if there was a war with Israel, or if somehow, you know, which some people in the West seem to dream about, if Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, took over in Gaza, somehow persuaded Hamas, which is actually his condition for reconciliation of the two factions, Fatah and Hamas, that Hamas disarmed, then actually Fatah would not be able to exercise the kind of control that Hamas do in the interest, actually, of Egyptian security. And by that, I particularly mean that the worries that the Egyptians have that you could have a real backwash into the North Sinai. At the moment, Hamas are cooperating with Egypt in keeping some, you know, very sort of far-out extremist Salafists who would love to be in North Sinai fighting Egyptian forces, either in jail or at least preventing them from crossing the southern border into North Sinai. And I think in sheer realpolitik terms, Egypt regards at the moment, at least in the short term, until somebody comes up with a better idea, as they would see it, that actually Hamas is about the best answer to their own security in North Sinai that they've got. And I think also, actually, that there may be elements in the Israeli military who think along slightly similar lines. I mean, the fact is, Hamas is capable of controlling Gaza, and it's not at all clear that any of the alternatives would be.
Well, it's interesting. Back in the late 80s, Israel supported or allowed Hamas to develop as a counter to the secular PLO, but one of the problems with the secular PLO, of course, was the massive corruption as you write about that, that Arafat condoned, although he wasn't personally getting enriched from it. And so the election that was proposed and took place supposedly surprised the West and the United States when Hamas won it. But I have a hunch that Israel was secretly pleased. The idea of having an Islamist enemy was much more easy for them to justify repression to the world than having a secular one. What's your take on that?
Well, I think there's something in what you say, actually. I mean, I think that it's certainly true that Hamas, I mean, you're absolutely right that in the 80s, Hamas was seen by Israel as a counterweight to the secular PLO. I think that I'm considering your question very carefully. I think the actual election was probably quite a shock to the Sharon government because, of course, Hamas won a majority in the parliamentary elections, which, you know, effectively put it in charge of the PA, the Palestinian Authority, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now, that was problematic, I think, for the Israelis. But where I think you really, you know, ring a chord is that when Hamas took over militarily because of the failure to reach a sensible coalition agreement with Fatah, you know, for all sorts of reasons, not all of it by any means Hamas's fault, and it then took complete control in Gaza, then I think that was a moment that the Israelis did see an opportunity for exactly what you're talking about. It meant that there was this terrible division, and in a divide-and-rule sense, I think that was useful to the Israelis. Actually, in my book, I talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's come out of WikiLeaks shows that some Israeli intelligence figures were really making that explicit. And what's interesting is that the Americans, and I have to say to some extent the British, were keen to see Fatah win that brief and rather bloody civil war in the first half of 2007, culminating in Hamas taking over in June. But the Israelis weren't so keen. And in fact, the Israelis were not. I think the Israelis had a much more, apart from anything else, a much more realistic attitude about who was likely to win a confrontation between Fatah and Hamas. And they didn't join in with the enthusiasm that the Bush administration and, I have to say, my British government as well, in backing Fatah. And I think that, you know, absolutely plays to your point that a corrosive split between Fatah and Hamas, a separation of Gaza and the West Bank, has been regarded by most of Israel's security establishment is a good thing rather than a bad one.
And probably looking back, many of those who criticized Sharon for taking the Jewish settlers out of Gaza, the relatively few who criticized him for doing that, will look back and say it was a very shrewd move because that division has really enhanced Israel's position overall and made the likelihood of being forced to withdraw from the settlements much less likely. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's right, but I think you're completely right that in a way they can congratulate Sharon on that because he's sort of, as it were, they see it taken Gaza out of the equation. So, for example, if you look at the right-wing idea of annexing large parts of the West Bank, that's a more palatable prospect to people on the right because they know that if you take Gaza out of the equation, if you somehow lock it away in the way that the Israelis have attempted to do, then you're not going to have, you know, the big democratic sphere, obviously, is an Arab majority at some point in the whole of Mandatory Palestine. And that isn't going to happen if Gaza isn't part of what's under consideration, if you like. But I mean, I think you're right. I still, however, that's a paradox because those right-wingers who, as you say, might congratulate Sharon for having done that still I mean, their sort of default position is still we should never have withdrawn settlers from Gaza. And, of course, I mean, they're right in one way to worry about that, although I, broadly speaking, buy into your interpretation of what happened, because it did create a precedent. I mean, it did show that you can remove settlements from occupied territory, but I think it also, as you rightly say, paved the way for separation, really, of Gaza from the West Bank, a process which had begun much earlier, but which really intensified after that withdrawal in 2005.
My guest is Donald McIntyre. We are talking about his new book, Gaza, Preparing for Dawn. Let's talk about Gaza as how it has been described by a number of people as the world's largest open-air prison, and how the occupation has changed but remains an occupation.
Yes. I think for once that sort of cliche about because open-air prison is pretty justified. And I also do get there may be some very esoteric argument in international law to say that Gaza isn't occupied, but in any common sense terms, the fact that Israeli troops are, on the outside and indeed frequently came in, as we just discussed two weeks ago, but even more so the fact that Israel controls the airspace over Gaza, it controls the territorial waters to an extent that it can reduce fishing limits, as it recently did, to 3 nautical miles, when under the Oslo Agreement there was supposed to be 20 miles of fishing. The fact that every Palestinian berth in Gaza is registered by the Israeli authorities, and so on and so forth, seems to me crazy not to accept that this is an occupation. I mean, it's an occupation, as you put it, from the outside rather than from the inside, but it's still an occupation. Now, on the prison point, it's impossible, really, to talk to anybody in Gaza without this coming up. I mean, it is impossible for the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza to get out temporarily. It's not easy to get out permanently, but, I mean, to get out temporarily and then be sure of getting back is virtually impossible for all but a tiny minority. And I think that has a sort of devastating effect on morale, on life in Gaza. And although, I think that, there were many factors, and we can talk about that if you like, behind the Great March of Return, these border protests that were running from March. But, I think it is possible, the Israelis call them riots, and they sort of were riots, and in a way they reminded me rather of prison riots. There were many factors in it, but, people were, that this frustration, this sense of enclosure, coupled with, terrible unemployment rates. After all, this is a territory from which, even after the Six-Day War, tens of thousands of Palestinians were leaving Gaza it was an occupation, but they were leaving Gaza to work in Israel. It's amazing, a lot of Palestinians in Gaza over 40 speak excellent Hebrew because they, used to work in Israel. That's all gone. It's become increasingly difficult for medical patients to get the treatment they need because it isn't available in Gaza. Just to use one example, radiation therapy in Gaza for cancer patients, so they have to be treated outside. Now, there is a trickle of people going out, but it's very difficult. It is almost impossible for relatives, if they're in the, age that most parents are, actually, 25 to 40, or 20 to 40, or 20 to 35, say, to take their own children, so the grandparents have to take the children if they're lucky enough to get a permit for treatment outside. I could go on and on. But yes, it does feel like a prison. And I think one of the paradoxes about what people feel about this in Gaza is that, on the one hand, you know, increasingly the polls show that a very large proportion, possibly about half of Palestinians in Gaza, would like to leave permanently. But the reason they would like to leave permanently is that they can't leave temporarily, if you see what I mean. It's, in other words, it's precisely because it does feel like a prison. And, you know, Gaza is home to a lot of these people. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not really that they want to turn their back on the place they live in or their families or the rest of it. It's just a lack of opportunities, and the fact that they feel trapped there tends to make people want to leave for good.
Well, you even point out in a number of situations where Gaza and people from the West Bank are sent to Gaza, even breaking up families, and in a way that they're sending to Gaza as Gaza being a prison, in the same way.
Yes, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you're right. And I mean, there are cases. I did, you know, talk to people who, you know, were married to Palestinians, and a guy who was married to a Palestinian in the West Bank, but he himself had Gaza ID, and he's just dumped back. Somebody finds in a West Bank checkpoint that he has Gaza ID, and he's just unceremoniously dumped back in Gaza away from his family. And you're right. I mean, Gaza is a sort of place that you can, it is like a prison in that sense. And indeed, you know, when the Hamas, when there was a prisoner swap deal to get the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit released by Hamas in return for a large number of prisoners, the most dangerous in Israel's view prisoners went to Gaza. You know, it is, you're right, it's the sort of place that you send people, but it's not a place that you you can easily get out of, or if you do get out of, in the case of this married civilian we were talking about, you know, he's there on sufferance, and once it's found that he's got Gaza ID, he goes straight back. So, yeah, it does operate a bit like a prison.
We're speaking with Donald McIntyre about his book, Gaza, Preparing for Dawn. One thing that has really puzzled me and troubled me is that Mahmoud Abbas, whose term as president expired almost a decade ago, and seems to be only propped up as president by Israel and the United States and Great Britain and the UK, has actively been involved with Israel in making life difficult for people in Gaza by pushing for cutting down the amount of electricity they get, which was already a low amount, in order to for them to bring Hamas to the ground. And Abbas has a long history now of collaboration with Israel since Oslo, but it's difficult for me to understand why Palestinians in the diaspora don't speak out about this.
Well, I mean, I think actually some do, but I take your point. I think that despite what you say about Abbas's long history of collaboration, I think actually there have been two Abbases, or at least two stages of Abbas in this story. I think up until the elections, and certainly up until 2007 when we had the civil war, but really up to the elections, I think Abbas did want to, you know, did see himself as the leader of the entire Palestinian people. He did spend some time after the elections, actually, but certainly after he became president, after his own election for the presidency, he spent some time trying to negotiate a ceasefire with Hamas, you know, to get Hamas to agree to a ceasefire, but also, you know, to try and get something in return from the Israelis. And he was very, very badly treated by the Israelis, in my view. I mean, Sharon had complained for a long time that, you know, he couldn't deal with Arafat, he wished Arafat was dead, blah, blah, blah. There was a guy who was completely against the armed struggle, and Sharon really treated him, you know, if anything, even worse than he treated Arafat. He didn't, for example, negotiate the kind of prisoner releases that would have boosted Abbas's authority. Now, why do I mention that? Because I think that, in a way, Israel's sort of... If he had wanted to emerge as a strong nationalist leader, Israel did everything, or at least Ariel Sharon did everything he could to deny him that opportunity and to not give him the kind of authority or help him achieve the kind of authority that he needed. Plus making a series of absurd demands like, you know, you've got to disarm or eliminate Hamas, you know, something that Israel had failed to do, so people could see how he could be prepared to do it. Then I think you're right. After 2006-07, I think he sort of, something happened, something flipped in him. And I think we still don't know exactly what, but he turned his back not only really on Hamas, but also on Gaza itself. And it has been really puzzling to me that he has introduced sanctions of his own on the Palestinian people in Gaza at a time when they are already suffering, you know, pretty gigantic privations, where, you know, the tunnels are not operating, there is absolutely no exports. You've got an imploded economy, and into this mix with, you know, already 70% unemployment for under 25 adults in Gaza. Abbas turns the taps off by cutting salaries of his own employees, and as you say, you know, for a while refusing to pay for the electricity that Israel pipes directly into Gaza. And what's even more amazing about this, I think, is, and more puzzling to me, is that he seems to be thinking that this will somehow bring Hamas to its knees, that there will be some kind of revolt or whatever. But I mean, this was the policy pursued by the Israelis and for a lot of the time by the Egyptians without achieving that objective. So it seems extraordinary that the Palestinian president feels that he can. And I mean, I think even the Egyptians now are getting a little impatient with his obduracy over this issue. Now, you know, I understand. He sees himself as a president. He doesn't want deals to be cut separately with Hamas. But the answer to that, I think, is a more creative approach to reconciliation between the two factions. And I fear that isn't going to happen until, you know, we get to a post-Abbas period.
Well, it's interesting. One might argue that for Israel, as for Abbas, the present situation is ideal in the sense that nothing is going to change. Abbas is getting on his years, but there seems to be no immediate threat to take him down. And he is actually abiding by the Oslo Agreement, which established the PA, Palestinian Authority, and its responsibility to repress further resistance to the Israeli occupation. And that's what he has been actually doing in the West Bank, no?
Well, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that he's certainly carrying out security cooperation with Israel, and I've no doubt that that makes it more difficult for organizations like Hamas in the West Bank. Additionally, I think he has become more authoritarian about civil society, and as Hamas is, to be fair, in Gaza, but both have tended to crack down on dissent, as a recent Human Rights Watch report underlined. Yes, I mean, I think that what's, if you like, disappointing about the situation is that there isn't much sign that, I mean, you know, for those of us who believe that it may be the kind of mobilization that might make a difference to this deeply intractable situation would be, you know, a kind of mass movement of civil disobedience or whatever, a kind of intifada without guns. That doesn't, you know, although theoretically Abbas and his colleagues believe in that, there's absolutely no sign that they're kind of stimulating it. So, it is, and of course, these are one of the reasons, I think, why he is becoming more and more unpopular because Palestinians in the West Bank don't see what they're getting in return for that cooperation, for security cooperation with Israel. I mean, I don't think a majority of the Palestinians necessarily are against. I mean, you know, most people want to get on with their lives at the moment unless they see a political project. So I'm not saying they want a return to, you know, an armed struggle which is going to endanger their family's lives. But obviously, you know, they see nothing happening now, which, by the way, is also one of the reasons for the rise of Hamas back over a decade ago. You know, there was negotiations were not producing anything, and sort of there was no political horizon. And I'm afraid we're back in that situation, or still in that situation.
I remember Arafat had 7 individual intelligence services. And that he was a master manipulator that and proved more than adept at getting around anyone who was trying to get rid of him. You know, it's interesting. Sharon, from what I could see, was the one Israeli who wanted to kill Arafat. He tried to do it in Lebanon, blew up a building. You mentioned the airplane he wanted to take down. He blew up a building in Lebanon where Arafat had been in. 154 people had died. But it appeared to me that Arafat was necessary because he was the only one who could legitimate a deal like Oslo, which in a sense legitimized Israel's presence in 60% of the West Bank. Nobody else could have done that. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think we're getting back. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that Oslo, I mean, the critics of Oslo at the time were, there was quite a wide range of people because it was not just Hamas, although Hamas did oppose Oslo, but also some of the people who'd been doing the very negotiations in Washington that it seemed the Oslo Accords undercut. I'm thinking particularly of Haider al-Shafi from Gaza, and then at that time Helen al-Sharawi and Faisal Husseini. And their criticism of Oslo was precisely that, you know, the settlements would not be curtailed. There was no specific mention of a Palestinian state and so on and so forth. And you're right. I mean, I think only Arafat could have delivered Oslo. I mean, I think we have to remember one thing. I mean, you know, the flaws in the Oslo Agreement are manifest. And, you know, many of them were pointed out to Arafat at the time. I mean, the one thing we do have to remember is that a large number of Palestinians at the time, and actually a large number of Israelis, saw, at least for the first 2 or 3 months, saw this as a hugely hopeful move, did believe it was a breakthrough. And I guess one of the counterfactuals of life is, you know, would somehow Rabin have, despite his, you know, very hard line earlier against the Palestinian state, might he have been brought finally to see that the Palestinian state of 22% of historic Palestine was worth having for the Israelis and might improve Israeli security? You know, we just don't know. All one can say is the right-wingers, including Benjamin Netanyahu, who incited against Rabin at that time, believed they were heading for a Palestinian state, as, of course, did Yigal Amir, who actually fired a bullet at Rabin. But no, your point is right. And, you know, frankly, we haven't seen since Arafat, for all his faults, we haven't seen a Palestinian leader capable yet of uniting the Palestinian people in the way that he did.
We're coming down to the end of the hour. I'm curious, I wanted to ask you about the subtitle of your book, Preparing for Dawn, because it seems optimistic, and yet I don't know. I'm a pessimist by nature. I don't see any positive future, but Preparing for Dawn sounds positive. Where did you come up with it? Do you see a positive future?
Well, yes. Well, it's an odd little story, this. There's a poem by Margaret Delwich, which he wrote actually running Gaza about in Ramallah in 2002 during the Second Intifada called State of Siege. And that the Arabic in that poem is he describes how, you know, the Palestinians are perpetually, you know, something's around the corner. They're kind of, and it's often translated, actually mistranslated, as preparing for dawn. You know, he's describing this feeling that, you know, something's going to happen, but somehow it never does. And actually, the correct translation is on the verge of dawn. But when I was reading this, I thought, and so I thought, on the verge of dawn actually is ridiculous, because, as you say, there isn't much sign of dawn. And then I thought, maybe the mistranslation is more appropriate to what's happening in Gaza, because it's true that there isn't, you know, there isn't much light at the end of the tunnel, to use another World War metaphor. But I do, and I talk quite a lot about this in my book, believe that the sort of resilience and creativity of Palestinians have somehow continued to go on. I'm talking in business, in the arts, despite the huge, in education, despite the unbelievable pressures on people in Gaza, those things continue to happen.
Donald?
I suppose my point is that yes. It's more preparing than being on the verge of it.
Well, Donald, we have to come to the crowded now. It's been very enlightening. Thanks so much for being our guest today in Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.